Hi, this is Circe Olson-Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Schooling with Uncle Sam. But for this particular topic today, I am not sure if this is going to be about schooling or about Together We Serve, so we may change our minds in the middle of this episode. I'm speaking with Dr. Deborah Kohler, and she's a professor at San Francisco State University, and we're talking today over the phone. She is in San Francisco, and I'm here in New Mexico. So, hi, Deborah.
Hi, Circe. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. We're getting used to this new normal of long-distance interviews.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you know, we've known each other for quite a long time, but, you know, I'm not really sure what, first of all, I'm not sure how we met, and I guess we'll talk about that a little later, but what is your tie to the military? Was your dad in the military?
You know, neither one of my parents were in the military, actually, but my grandfather, my father's father, served during the Korean conflict, and my dad was a little boy in Chicago during World War II, and so he has stories about helping out with the Victory Gardens, you know, having discussions around the dinner table about rationing and, you know, whether they were going to have, you know, where they got their meat, and he also has a very vivid memory of being a 5 or 6 year old little boy sitting on the front stoop of his Chicago apartment building watching the big VE parade from the Victory in Europe. So he has memories of being a little boy on the home front, and he also has the experience of having his dad serve when he was a slightly older child.
Yes, you're right about that, the Korean War. So actually, let's get back to you, and then this is going to double back into a wartime conversation in a few minutes. But I know that you teach in the Women and Gender Studies department at your university, but, you know, we think we know what Women and Gender Studies is all about, but can you tell our listeners a little bit more about the discipline? What kind of classes do students take, and what kind of jobs they'll get after they graduate?
Those are great questions, and they're questions that I really love to answer, because there is sort of the sense of, like, we think we know what this is, but we're not sure. Women and gender studies is really an area of study that helps all of us, you know, of whatever gender we are, to think about how our ideas about gender came to be in the world. So, like, why do we think about men and women and trans people in these particular ways? It has a history. It's related to other categories such as race and class and military status. And so just sort of helping students think critically about how we come to have the assumptions that we do. So, you know, I teach graduate students. I also teach an undergraduate course called Gender, War, and Militarism. And in that class, I have women and gender studies students who have no experience with the military. I have veterans. I have military spouses. I have brats. And it may be their first gender studies class. But sort of thinking about the ways in which the military shapes and responds to the stereotypes and the limitations that we have around ideas of gender.
Oh, cool. So when you mentioned that you have veterans in the class, do men also take these classes, or are your classes strictly female?
Oh, yeah. No, we have people of all genders taking our classes. I mean, usually there is a majority of women students, but we have a lot of transgender students. We have male students. We have students who are not sure what their gender identity is, and we have a lot of female students. But so, particularly in the war class, it does attract a range of students from, you know, male, female, trans students, absolutely.
My son is taking criminal justice, and he had to take a class on race and you know, the criminal justice system. So it was interesting to see, you know, the different classes that people like military studies or criminal justice, they take, because this is so important to understand a larger population.
Yeah, and to understand the reality of our world. I mean, you can't really, I would not want people to be working in criminal justice that didn't have a sense of the history of racism and racial divisions in criminal justice. Mm-hmm. I would not, you know, I'm really happy when I have veterans and male spouses and brats in my gender war and militarism class coming and talking about their experiences, and it becomes much less abstract.
So what kind of jobs do these people get? The people that graduate with a women and gender studies degree, what kind of jobs do they get after graduation?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a liberal arts degree, so in some ways, you know, we have a lot of students who go on to law school or medical school or become nurses, or who get jobs, you know, just as managers in corporations. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the specific gender studies component, we have a lot of students that work in social services, mm-hmm. Or who work in government services. We have a lot of students who become teachers. So it's really a degree that helps people think about serving other people. So lots of folks, like, you could go in and become a manager of a women's shelter, you know, or do work on underserved youth, that kind of thing.
Okay. So I know that you wrote a book and you're working on another book. You've probably written many books, but the one I wanted to talk to you about today was a book called Citizen Invert Queer, Lesbianism and War in the Early 20th Century Britain. And so just could you give us a brief overview of this book in particular?
Sure, absolutely. And you know, it's always a challenge to ask an academic to be brief, but I'll do my very best.
All right.
It's a book that looks at the ways in which British ideas about sexuality and gender changed as a result of World War I. So there's sort of a before, during, and after approach to ideas about sexuality, and in particular ideas about female same-sex sexuality, about lesbianism in Britain, and how the home front experience during World War I really transformed the way English people thought about women's roles and about female same-sex sexuality.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. My mother-in-law was a teenager in Scotland during World War II, and she says that in some way World War II was the best thing to happen for women career-wise. And so I imagine that you're going to say that it started in World War I with women in the home front there having to work. But tell me, what do you think about her statement about that it really helped, World War II really helped women? And then also go back a little bit more about your book in specific.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, I think World War II was really a transformative moment in a lot of ways. And I want to be really careful not to forget the huge human cost of war, both, you know, in terms of civilian casualties, military casualties, of course, during World War II, the Holocaust. So I don't want to romanticize war, you know, and there were tremendous food shortages and the blitzes, the bombings. It was a terrible time. And it also was a time when women were asked to step into roles that had previously been denied to them, right? And so you had, because so many of the able-bodied men in England and Scotland, if we want to take your mother-in-law's case, were serving in the military and were at war and were dying and were unavailable for the work of the nation. Women had the opportunity, and some might say the patriotic duty or obligation, or some might say that they were, you know, sort of coerced into, though I think that I would not agree with that coercion piece, but women were encouraged and asked and recruited to do work that had previously been denied to them. And they had much more freedom in many ways.
You know, we think about,
given this horrible time of restriction and death and fear.
Yeah, we think of Rosie the Riveter, and I think even, you know, and you think of some of the women that became WASP and became ambulance drivers and factory workers. But let's go back to World War One, which is where your book focuses. How did the Great War change the British understandings of lesbianism and women's role in general?
Yeah. Well, in terms of women's role in general, I think the ideas we have about World War II do go back in some ways to World War One. I mean, women were driving ambulances into France in World War One, and that was a huge way in which women could become involved in the war, really the only way that women could serve on the front. Was, you know, they formed, you know, ambulance corps, and they took the ambulances into France and literally were on the front lines. And that was the way during World War One that women who wanted to literally serve on the front lines were able to.
And nursing too, right?
Yeah, nursing too in the nursing sort of zones. Yeah, the ambulance drivers would drive to the front, pick up the wounded, and then take them back to the nursing stations for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In terms of the ideas about female sexuality and lesbianism, it's a little bit complicated, but there was the homophobic perception in England that the Germans were trying to infiltrate the male homosexuals of Britain and thus weaken the nation. You know, there were these wild rumors of German spies coming across the Channel and literally having sex with British male soldiers in order to weaken the British army. And so there was all this male homophobia circulating at the same time that women were being encouraged to be sort of strong and present in the public sphere. And there was homophobia against women as well, but homosexuality became a subject that people could talk about in a way that it wasn't before this. I mean, there was the Oscar Wilde scandal in the 1890s, but people were talking about lesbian scandals and making sure that women didn't become lesbians, or were those ambulance drivers all lesbians? Not using that word, using words like sapphist or invert. But there was a discussion of female homosexuality in a way that there hadn't been before. And in 1918, there was even a law introduced to criminalize female homosexuality, which had not been criminalized before because it didn't exist, according to the law. So, in some ways, the homophobic discussions of lesbianism actually enabled people to think about lesbianism in a way that they hadn't before. Before, it didn't even exist. There were male homosexuals, and there were women, and that was it.
So, what made you want to write this book?
You know, it's funny. My graduate dissertation, when I was doing my PhD, was on the lesbian novelists of the early 20th century. And as I was finishing my dissertation, I realized there's a big war in the middle of this book that I haven't even thought about, or a big war in the middle of this dissertation that I haven't really thought about. And my advisor said, finish your dissertation, deal with the war later. And so that's what I did. I turned in my dissertation, and then I started to work after I got my job at San Francisco State on what does it mean that all this happened while this war was going on. And the more I dug into it, the more I realized how central the home front politics of World War One were to these transformations that I had been tracking in my graduate work.
Wow. Interesting. It is an interesting topic that I imagine quite a few people haven't thought about. You know, when the last depiction of World War One and women I saw on TV, of course I'm not a big TV watcher, was Downton Abbey, when, you know, they turned the house into a hospital. You know, but I never thought about this greater conversation of lesbianism and homosexuality and the war. And so,
yeah, what happens when all the men are in one place and all the women are in another place and they're not together, you know, all those sort of fears about what will happen.
So I want to change the subject because we need to be brief, but I know you're working on another book, because when we first met, and I feel like we've known each other forever, but I think we've only known each other for a few years. You were researching a book on military spouses, and you came here to use our archive, but also to do focus groups. But why are you interested in military spouses, and just tell us a little bit about this new project.
Absolutely. Well, I was finishing the World War One project during the end of 2001, when September 11th, 2001 happened, and I was really struck by the parallels that I was seeing between my work that I was doing on home front Britain in World War One and what was happening in our new home front in the United States after 9/11. And the first book was about the transformation of lesbian sexuality during war. And the new book is about what happens to women on the home front in this post 9/11 world. And so I'm asking the same questions, like, how does war change our ideas about gender and nationalism and race and sexuality? But I felt like I was seeing stereotypes in the media, like the long-suffering spouse or the caretaking spouse. And I just thought, there is more to it than that, and I really want to know these stories.
Well, and now, of course, we have same-sex couples in the military, and we have male spouses, and
single spouses have unexpectedly come together in ways that I would not have anticipated when I started the military spouse book.
Yeah. So, why was this important to you, though? Because,
you know, I don't have a very strong personal connection to the military. You know, I can walk into a room full of military spouses and vets, and everyone knows that I'm a civilian. You know, it's important to me because I think these are the kinds of things that shape our ideas about who we are as a people, as a nation. And I think that the public representation of ideas about militarism and the individual experiences of people involved in the military and the perceptions of people who are not involved in the military really shape how we think about ourselves. And I'm increasingly disturbed by the ways in which our nation seems to be split into two different camps. You know, we're getting increasingly polarized. And I feel like military folks are struggling in the middle there because there's a perception of the military as very monolithic, and that's simply not true. And because so few people have a personal relationship to folks who are serving, if you look at the overall population of the U.S.,
there's
a lot of misperceptions, and I think it's really important to address the relationship between the stereotypes and our political culture and public policy and how we think about ourselves as a nation.
So when you came out to the museum, you did a focus group, and we had both male and female spouses. We had some dual military couples, and so you were asking questions. I was only sort of on the edge because I was doing something else. But what kind of questions are you asking when you're getting information from these military spouses to form your book?
Well, I try to ask open-ended questions, but I'm particularly interested in how they relate to the military hierarchy. And then also how they think about themselves in relationship to, like, popular culture, to perceptions of military people. You know, I read blogs, I look at films, I talk to people, and I want to, when I'm talking to military spouses, I'm interested in their experiences of the military, but I'm also interested in how they think about the way people think about them.
Very cool. Have you learned anything startling yourself, or?
Oh my gosh, so much. I know we should be wrapping up soon, so I'm trying to think quickly.
Yeah, well, I'll give you a sec.
I think the complexity of military spouses' relationships to military hierarchy and military bureaucracy continues to surprise me. I expected people to have complicated relationships, but there's such a desire for service with some people, and then an anger at what the system is doing to them. And then there's also folks who feel like they had no other choice but to join the service to serve, or to, you know, they just happened to fall in love with someone who was in the military. And the ways in which their lives are shaped and manipulated is very challenging.
Well, we'll leave it at that. That was a good answer for, you know, no sudden, you know, no warning. So I thought you did pretty well. So I know you've been working on the book for a couple of years. When are you planning to complete it?
You know, I actually don't know. I've had personal and family health challenges that have slowed me down, and now we're having this global pandemic. I try to get a chunk of it done every summer when I'm not teaching, and I'm hoping it'll come out as soon as I possibly can.
Well, I wish you the best with it. I'm excited to read it, especially since you came and looked over some of our files and had a focus group. I'd like to think that somehow our museum has kind of given a titch of help in it.
The museum has been an amazing help, and the museum is really shaping my thinking. And though the book may not come out immediately, there will be articles that will come out before the book. So you will be seeing the museum and its influence in my thinking much sooner than we will see the actual book between its bindings.
Well, thank you. And I wasn't fishing for any sort of compliment
or
anything.
No, but it's true. I mean, having the connection to the museum has been a really, really important part of how I'm engaging with and thinking about military families and military spouses as part of those. It's a fantastic place, and I know you're not fishing, but it's a terrific resource.
Well, thank you very much. So we have a second, we have about a minute. So is there anything you'd like to say about either your book or upcoming projects or your upcoming class, or a little bit more about your class with, you know, with the military aspect to it? You have a minute, so just give us something.
Well, I will say two things. I am very excited to have been involved in the Shout Project with the museum the LGBT visibility sharing stories. And I'm really excited about working with the museum on developing a curriculum that goes with the Shout Play. So that's one project I'm very excited about. I'll also be teaching my militarism class in the fall, and I am looking forward to getting involved with the veteran group on campus and hoping to draw more vets and more military family folks to the course as I continue to work on my research and my community involvement as well.
Well, thank you very much, Deborah, for your insights here. So I'm still not sure where our podcast fits. If it's Schooling with Uncle Sam, because we did talk a lot about education, but maybe it should actually go over to Together We Serve, because we seem to talk a lot more about service and country. Where do you think that this podcast should be archived, under education or under service?
Well, as someone who teaches and researches in an interdisciplinary kind of crossover field, I think it could go in either, and I would actually put it in both, or have the link in both places.
Oh, that's a good answer. Well,
it's a yes and answer.
Well, listen, it has been a pleasure talking to you on this kind of gloomy day here in New Mexico, but you've brightened me up. And I thank you very much for participating in this small podcast. And so, once again, this is Circe Olson-Wessner, the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tijeras, New Mexico. And I was speaking to Dr. Deborah Kohler from San Francisco State University. And this is our podcast, and we will determine where we put it after we finish this conversation. But I
thank you, Circe.
Thank you so very much. It was a great pleasure talking with you.